Good morning. Good morning and welcome to the West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, affectionately known as WUF. I'm Salima Mawson. My pronouns are she and her, and it is my privilege to share time with you in community this morning. Whoever, wherever, and however you are right now, whether you're here in the sanctuary, downstairs, or at home watching on screen, we're glad to have you with us. We're very glad to have you with us. Whatever your age, abilities, color of your skin, whomever you love, how you identify your gender, or where you call home, whether you have a relationship with religion or not, and whether your heart is joyous or hurting this morning, you are welcome here in your wholeness. Our service this morning is titled Freedom and Justice. I can't do everything, but still I can do something. And for the next hour or so, you will see and hear from folks who have an abiding interest in working for both of those. We hope to engage your mind and your hearts and perhaps give you some ideas about where to direct some of your energy this year.
All right, you hear me better now?
Yeah.
All right, I'll start over. My name is Wendy Clues. Good morning. I use she, her pronouns, and I am the co-leader, along with Megan Essler, of the WUF Social Justice Steering Committee. If you'd like to know more about what the committee does and the projects we work on, everyone is welcome to join us at our monthly meetings, held the second Monday of each month at 4 p.m. here at WUF. I also encourage you all to sign up for our monthly social justice newsletter. This is an easy way to stay informed and take action. More information on this and the committee can be found downstairs at the social justice table in the coffee room. My reading today is an excerpt from the book Heal Your Way Forward by Maisha T. Hill, who is a Black anti-racist educator and mental health advocate. If you looked only at the external world, it would seem as though we're walking through a daily shit show of the unknown. Media is constantly bombarding us with messages that dysregulate our nervous systems, keeping us in constant states of flight, fight, or freeze. Our interpersonal relationships can feel like a constant push and pull with no direction and no give, while our lives can feel like the Bill Murray movie Groundhog Day. You wake up to life events every day hoping something will be different, only realizing that life is on repeat. You crave radical change, peace of mind, and substance only to find more fear, drama, and insecurity. But like Bill's character in the movie, eventually you see a way to turn life's repetitive cycle into your own adventure. That's the joy of the journey, waking up and realizing you get to choose what anti-oppression, abolition, and liberation look and feel like to you. And then you get to feel your way into being a part of the greater collective moving toward freedom. By now you know that the system is working exactly the way it's supposed to. Many would say it's broken, but after seeing my ancestors fight to the death to fix it, only to have Supreme Courts, governments, and policies continue to tear down their work, I can say it isn't broken. It's working exactly as it was intended. I'm not saying don't advocate for policies and systemic change. What I am suggesting is that we speak up for our rights while working in tandem to collectively focus on repairing ourselves, nurture meaningful relationships, and restore humanity's call to justice. When we reimagine collective liberation, we can build sustainable change, which is why integration of the head, heart, and hands is critical for this work to be nuanced and whole.
Thank you. Good morning. I am the Reverend Connie Yost. an affiliated community minister here at WUF. So, as I'm sure you all know, Unitarian Universalism draws wisdom from many sources, including world religions, secular sources such as poetry and science, reason, and our own direct experience. One of our UU sources reads that we draw our faith from the words and deeds of prophetic people who challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. As a minister, I am constantly guided by the words and deeds of Martin Luther King Jr., who combined a deep faith and spirituality with the hard, dangerous work of social justice. You have probably heard the saying from the Bible that faith without works is dead. But that passage in James 2 ends by saying, "As the body without spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead." Our faith, Unitarian Universalism, has often been characterized as one of deeds without creeds. And though we may have different ideas about the nature of God or what is holy, we do not believe anything we want. Unitarian Universalism is guided by our shared ethical and moral values, as outlined formally in our seven principles of our of the congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association. So our sources and principles call us to be full human beings, recognizing that we are spiritual beings living in an interdependent web of life, with responsibility and accountability to all living beings on the earth. It is not hard to recognize that there is much work to do to live out our principles. And I know many of you are doing good work, restoring and protecting the earth, honoring the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and ensuring justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. But I want to remind you that acting in the world for justice is hard work for the long haul. We need to ground our social justice activities in a deep spiritual connection to that which we consider holy and life-sustaining. I will call this deeds and practice, deeds and connection, and deeds and community. So let me explain. In my ministry with farm workers, I'm the president of Farm Worker Ministry Northwest, and I'm on the board of the National Farm Worker Ministry. We respond to farm workers' requests for our support, which means anything from signing petitions and letters to coming out and attending farm worker rallies and pickets to accompanying them in meetings with management. So farm workers, though recognized as essential nowadays, are definitely part of the human scrap and disposable living labor that Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of back in 1967. We advocate with farm workers for years and years and years, decades, as the president of the United Farm Workers said, for the tiniest of wins. Farm workers do incredibly difficult and dangerous work, and the work of justice for them is definitely long haul. So I admit it. I get tired. I get weary. I get discouraged. Everybody eats, but so few people seem to want to know what goes into getting their food to the grocery store, much less working directly to address the injustices of farm labor. So in order to sustain myself in the work of justice, I have my spiritual practices of journaling, contemplation, meeting with my spiritual director, taking time in nature alone and with friends, working in my garden, and traveling to experience the awe and wonder of the earth. This is what I mean by deeds and practice, spiritual practice. As a minister, I offer spiritual formation classes, such as the Wellspring Sacred Earth class, that helps us strengthen ourselves as spiritual people who care about the earth and all living beings. As we develop our ability to see what is around us, we experience the beauty and react in awe and wonder and gratitude for the gifts we receive. This is what I mean by deeds and connection. I also draw strength and sustenance from the farm workers and other workers I support and the community of allies I serve with. It is so important to have a community of allies. I encourage you to ground your social justice work with others. There are many interfaith organizations working together for justice. The social justice group here at WOOF. I think there'll be a handout after this service with some opportunities. So this is what I mean by deeds and community. And finally, I give myself permission to focus my desire to do something to help in the area where I'm most passionate. We can't do it all. For me, especially as I am aging, it's an ongoing process to figure out how best to use my time for justice while not sacrificing my time honoring my own spirituality, connecting with my God, having fun, and being with friends. So find the one thing that you care passionately about and go deep with that. Join with others in an organization dedicated to justice. Find a spiritual practice and do it regularly. Take a spiritual formation class. Get out in nature. Take time to breathe deeply, notice, and feel gratitude. Then go out and save the world.
I'm Jen Fife Adams. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm the new congregational administrator here at WOOF. I started at the end of January. I only hope that I can someday meet the greatness of my predecessor, Pat Lycan. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my social justice journey. So on November 9th, 2016, I was in deep shock. Like many of us here, I had worked to get Hillary Clinton elected, and I expected her to win. That didn't happen. So after the loss, I threw myself into making pussy hats for all that I knew. I ended up making 25 hats that went all over the country, including to Washington, D.C. You might recognize at least one of the wearers. Anyone who sits in the back near me during services has probably noticed that I'm a knitter and that I'm pretty serious about it. So the effects of that action were to put my pain to work. I was so incredibly upset when Trump got elected. I have two queer kids, and I was fearful for what the future was going to look like for them. So if knitting with intention could have this good effect, what else could? So it made me look for other actions to take, knowing that group action seemed to be the most effective, and that might be a theme that you notice again and again today. So Roger Golliver is my best friend, and he and I met after he retired. So his wife, Karen Stratton, was my elder kiddo's fourth grade teacher. And he and I ended up volunteering together at Sexton Mountain Elementary in the Beaverton School District. And that year we were host to the newcomers program of the Beaverton School District, which supports youth that have experienced interrupted learning, have experienced trauma, and are often refugees and asylum seekers. So this group of refugees and asylum seekers clearly did not have enough to eat. The government might have let them into our country, but they didn't necessarily set them up with resources, and I think a lot of us are really familiar with that. So our group of parents and retirees went about figuring out how to get more food for these kids. And we quickly decided that we would be called Planting Seeds. I think many of us are familiar with that quote, "What didn't you do to bury me, but you forgot that I was a seed." That poster on the right was created by my younger kid, who's an artist. There was a lot of joy in doing this. So, again, group action that countered Trump's anti-immigration and anti-refugee executive orders. Also, it was just intensely local, right? So our group was taking direct action in our community and seeing immediate results. But I was still so angry, again, like so many of us. So I decided to run for the Beaverton School Board that year. And this is when I was in hot and heavy in the campaign. The downsides of running for the school board was it felt really lonely. I wasn't aligned with a group, so I didn't feel like I had that group with me doing this work. Also, I discovered that I don't like being in the spotlight unless I'm highlighting ideas or groups that I support rather than highlighting myself. I really don't like that part of saying, "I am so awesome, vote for me because me. That is just not who I am. So I dutifully went and answered many questions, met with many people, did all the stuff that you're supposed to do, and just felt so intensely lonely going through that experience. So after losing that race, and I have no regrets. I met so many people, and it led me to the work that I do now in many different spaces, and it certainly helped me gain confidence in my abilities. But it also helped me refocus myself on the work that I loved. And so this is a picture from our first flurry of giving. So if you've talked with Roger about planting seeds in the past, it's our holiday program that we do every year. And when we first started, obviously people could see each other, and we had giving trees around the community, and we supported newcomers by asking for specific gifts for them. So we got many carloads of gifts. And we just kept doing that work. And then with the start of the pandemic, we realized that having the ability to be online and actually be a nonprofit that had the 501c3 recognition would help us do that work better. So Roger and I did the work of becoming an official nonprofit. And this was our first major action during the pandemic, that we did a remote 5K where people could do a 5K on their own and send us the money for it. And we were able to raise $5,000. And we continue our work. We are still Planting Seeds Community of Beaverton. So the work that Roger, I, and the other Cedars have done has filled our buckets and helped many, and this is just from a recent thank you note that we got to support more than 100 newcomers, again, just survive in the United States. So here is some of what we've accomplished. So since we started planting seeds, we've raised more than $40,000 to support Beaverton's marginalized students. So it hasn't just been the newcomers. I worked at ACMA for 4 years before I started working here, and that's the, if you're not familiar, that's the Arts and Communication Magnet Academy. So it pulls students from the entire Beaverton School District who have a passion for the arts. My elder kid went all 7 years there. We've provided more than 10,000 meals. Our Flurry of Giving program has helped hundreds of families, and that during the pandemic switched into a gift card program, and it's actually more effective now because with Fred Meyer, Target, and Winco gift cards, families can choose what they want and what they need, and so they get these gift cards over winter break. We provide them over spring break, and in the past, we have provided them during summer breaks as well. We've donated hundreds of books to Title I libraries. So, again, if you have a familiarity with the school district and schoolwork, Title I schools are those that have a lot more students who are facing poverty. And so, therefore, they have parents who can't necessarily run book fairs and can't necessarily donate money to help support the school as much. So, again, we've been able to get lots and lots of books into those libraries. We've partnered with multiple school groups to help them raise funds for needy students. And we have supported other local nonprofits through our work as well. If you want to read more about us, you are welcome to go to www.plantingseedscommunity.org. So in Planting Seeds, Roger acts as our treasurer, and then his work continues. He is also part of the Social Justice Committee here at WOOF, and he focuses on food distribution locally and guides the Aloha Huber Park program. So food insecurity hits one out of every four Oregon families, and I went online to confirm that data last night, and actually it's one out of four Beaverton families deal with food insecurity, one out of five in Oregon, which is only increasing, driven by the ongoing economic fallout of the pandemic and rising costs because of inflation. And if you're wondering who is most affected by food insecurity, Black, Indigenous, communities of color, immigrants and refugees, single moms, and gender diverse communities. Whereas in my work, I focus on fundraising for Planting Seeds, and I also do board work in the community. So the big board work that I do is at Home Plate Youth Services, and you guys, thank you, WOOF. You have supported Home Plate a lot through the years, most recently through the sock drive. So we are very grateful for that. So housing insecurity impacts more than 2,700 students in the Beaverton School District. The Beaverton School District itself has the greatest number of housing insecure students in the state of Oregon. There's probably a correlation with the fact that Beaverton is the most diverse community in the state of Oregon. So as I mentioned, since 2021, I've been on the board for Home Plate Youth Services, and I am currently the co-chair. So Spencer Ehrman recently joined the board, and he's going to tell you more about them. So thank you very much for letting me speak.
Jen Fife Adams, community activist and congregational administrator. Thanks. I'm Spencer Ehrman. Good morning. My pronouns are he and him. I'm a fourth generation Portlander, and I grew up in a family that has been, for all those generations, completely devoted to community service and philanthropy. And so I'm genetically predisposed to get up to my armpits and whatever in some things that are going on. Excuse me. I've worked in environmental justice. I've worked with on the board of an organization that provides grief support to kids. When I lived in Seattle, I worked as a volunteer CASA. Youth and children have always drawn my attention. If we don't care for our kids, who are we as a people? Who are we as a society? 6 years ago or so, I went to work for the Beaverton School District as a bus driver. Did that for a couple of years and met several hundred students during those 2 years that I had the privilege of getting to know a little bit, of getting them to school and back home again. And as part of our orientation, and this is 6 years ago, we were told that there are 1,800 students in the Beaverton School District who are experiencing housing insecurity. Housing insecurity. Precariously housed. Housing unstable. Homeless. Houseless. This issue is so permeates our society today that we can't even agree on what to call it. But the fact is that there are still 1,800 students in the Beaverton School District who may not know where they're going to get to sleep tonight. Think about that. We had some kids up here today who got to listen to Bert and Ernie, and they get to go to their RE class. Kids their age in Beaverton and in Washington County don't know where they're going to get to sleep tonight. How can we be doing this? How can we allow this to go on? It's inexcusable. Pisses me off. Sorry. Somebody said shit, though, earlier, so I guess... So, I guess the door is open. In my work in philanthropy and in community service, as I indicated, children have become more and more my focus. And so I was honored to get to join the board of Home Plate Youth Services. Home Plate provides a solution in Washington County and specifically in Beaverton. Home Plate uplifts and empowers young people experiencing housing instability through community building, education, and access to services and resources. Home Plate envisions a welcoming community where all youth feel a sense of belonging and value, where housing is safe, accessible, and sustainable. We treat each youth and each other with respect, caring, honesty, and an open mind. Our work is about meeting youth where they are. We are grounded in open and honest communication, respect for the place where youth are on life's journey, compassion for the burdens they carry, a belief in their independence and power, and a space where they feel a sense of ownership and belonging. Home Plate provides a safe and welcoming place for homeless youth ages 12 through 24 to access a free meal, shower facilities, laundry, hygiene and clothing supplies, and activities at its drop-in centers. Outreach workers go out on the streets and in the community to meet youth where they are and to provide them with resource assistance. Our employment team connects youth with job resources and opportunities and provides them with employment skills and coaching. Our education team connects youth around different types of education, including some scholarships, and funds to support youth while they're in school. Our housing team works to secure housing for youth and then helps them with support services once they are in a home of their own. We also arrange youth outings to explore the community and bring special activities to the drop-in space for youth to develop and share skills. I was stunned to learn that youth in some circumstances have not experienced how to shop, how to stock a home, how to clean. It's astonishing to me that this is actually reality. And the work that we do to provide those skills, to share those skills with youth, is invaluable. In addition to meeting these basic needs, HomePlate incorporates trained adult mentors to build positive relationships with the youth. Mentors listen, help youth process their situations, recognize achievements, and provide guidance and support. Through these positive relationships, youth are better equipped to access other community resources and make positive choices. The work that HomePlate is doing is invaluable and irreplaceable. And my hope is that HomePlate can continue to grow and provide solutions to the nearly 2,600 students in Washington County, Tigard, Hillsborough, Forest Grove, Cornelius. We have children living in the streets, in forests, camping, couch surfing, not knowing where they're going to sleep tonight, not knowing if they're going to have clean clothes, not knowing if they're going to get to stay with their parent, not knowing where the next meal is coming from. I'm stunned to know this, and it bothers me a lot. And I hope that you will join us. Cool. I hope that you will join us in our mission to be a solution in Washington County to this growing tragedy that we as a society have seen fit to burden our children with. Thanks.
Thank you, Spencer. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Connie. Thank you, Wendy. We are this weekend what we call in America Memorial Day weekend. Under the guise of remembering the fallen heroes from all those wars that have never failed to produce two losers, we turn our eyes to the light of the summer that is on its way and think about all that we have to be grateful for. We live in a still mostly beautiful state where so far our schools and libraries have not banned books. American history is still permitted to be taught. Where reproductive health is respected and readily available to all women. And where our kids get to choose their pronouns and receive the affirming care they need. One of our hymns, Gather the Spirit, reminds us that here at WOOF, we are able to gather in peace, gather in thanks, gather in sympathy now and then, gather in hope, compassion, and strength, gather to celebrate once again. And it is in this spirit that we gratefully receive your offerings. whether they be in the form of financial support, which is, of course, absolutely important to our sustainability, or your acts of loving kindness, joining a work party to keep our grounds beautiful, providing technical support for our Sunday services, keeping our coffee hour supplied with treats, or serving as a Sunday morning greeter, or helping in the kitchen with our monthly group soup. Your gifts are a vital part of what makes WOOF work as a beloved community that we are building together. Another hub, one of our hymns, says ever so simply, from you I receive, to you I give. Together we share, and from this we live. If the ushers will come forward, please, we will gratefully receive your offerings this morning. Thank you all. Couldn't be a better introduction to my talk. So I'm Jean Trigstead, and environment is one of my passions. Climate is everywhere. This was on Time magazine during the pandemic. And climate is everything, and I just add one word to that. Climate justice is everything. So I'm going to tell a little story. It's about the people, past and present, of Linton, Oregon. It's about fossil fuel, and it's about city government. It's about displacement and endangerment of humans and non-humans. It's about power and resistance. So this is 1909. And this is an illustration from the Oregonian. And it's really fascinating because it's the beginning of it all. So on the left you see there's the lumber mills, there's a couple of them, there's the railroad, there's a steel company, there's a wood distilling company. I don't know what the heck that is. And then those little itty-bitty houses along the railroad track, that's where the immigrant workers lived, some of them. And then above it was the beautiful Tualatin Hills, an ancient, ancient forest. And there was a lot going on. So that was 1909. And then in 1911, there was a very large fire. And that fire destroyed many of the tanks, and it was quite a conflagration. But what happened was one of the walls collapsed on the fire chief. And that was a real event. And the mayor the next day said, I deem this to be a hazard and that we need to do something about this. These spills could happen, life and property could be in danger, and by golly, we're going to do something. And they did. They did put in some safety measures, stricter measures. But then, 3 years later, there's a new mayor, and those measures disappeared. So maintenance safety standards were gone. And a lot of things got gone during that time. And one was Guild Lake, which was this beautiful lake in that same area. And a bunch of developers from the East Coast, and even, if you can imagine, the Portland Harbor Board of Directors were just gung-ho to bury this lake so they could dig up the Willamette River and improve shipping, because the Willamette River was very shallow. It was probably 6 feet deep. And so these men had these grandiose ideas, which they materialized, unfortunately. And so this area became partly what is known as Montgomery Park. And then a lot of other things started to happen. Portland annexed Linton and St. John's and Albina. This is an amazing statistic to me. 60,000 homes were demolished over this time, not all at once, but over time. And I went back and I thought, that can't be right. It must be 6,000. No, 60,000. So those people were displaced, many more people. We know the river was dredged, the wetlands disappeared, the forest was logged, and the lumber was sent back to the East Coast. And the number of oil companies continued to expand in this time. Now we're going to leap forward to 2007. And this was a headline somewhere, oil production in North Dakota increased exponentially, and that was due to fracking technology. So now technology is allowing us to take, as one oil industry executive was heard to have said, every molecule of oil and gas from the earth will be here until the final molecule is extracted. This is just an illustration of the red line is the railroad, the lines that travel from those North Dakota fracking fields through to the Willamette and out overseas. So I don't think many people know that 90% of the oil that is stored there and is shipped through these tank cars is sent overseas. It's not used by Oregonians. And the tanks, since the oil increased exponentially, so did the number of oil tankers. And in 2016, there was an explosion in Moser. Some of you probably remember that. 16 tankers derailed, and that explosion was quite significant to that community. It took 14 hours to put that fire out. 42,000 gallons of oil into the river and into the groundwater. And a year later, when they tested the groundwater, it was still contaminated. And after that, I couldn't find any records, but I suspect it wasn't gone the next year. So here's a picture of where the oil tankers stop, and all that oil is pumped into 600 oil tanks that sit on about 6 miles of the river. That's 300 million gallons. The spill in Moser was 42,000 gallons. So there's a lot of oil. This is an aerial view of what is now Forest Park, second generation, and the oil tankers. So the legacy that was started 100 years before of industry occupying this area and pretty much freewheeling anything they wanted to do, not much regulation, was finally codified in 2001 when the city of Portland adopted the Guild Lake Industrial Sanctuary. Now, industrial sanctuary, those two words do not go together. I mean, think about it. What do you think about when you think about a sanctuary? A place of refuge, a place of rest, a haven, an oasis, safe place. How dare they use that word? Because people will see that and think something completely different if they don't know the history. So 1,600 acres now are protected from non-industrial use through zoning. And what this effectively does is it prohibits community action, community involvement in any kinds of improvements in that area. So, and then from the song, you know that there's 15 miles of a Superfund site. So 120 years of industrial spill-off has produced 15 miles of dioxins and PCBs and literally hundreds of toxins. So I'm going to spend some time on this. This is a local organization. There's lots of activity around this, but there's also lots of significant resistance. So remember that we've got the 600 tanks, we've got the 6 miles, and we all have heard of the Cascadia subduction, and the possibility is increasing that that will happen at some time in the future. That will be a phenomenal disaster, hopefully can be averted. There are people working on that, and it's estimated it'll take about 10 years to actually get what's needed to be done to make that area safe, and that's quite a while. But in the meantime, the people who have been there, the generations and generations of people who've lived in that area, that lived in Linton, are faced with the public health issues around the toxins that are already there, that are present in the soil and the air and the water. And to me, climate justice is about clean air, clean water, clean soil, and just some of the things it's hard to read, but there are toxic releases that happen there both continuously and accidentally. And those releases of spills are completely within the purview of the Zenith and the other industries there to clean them up. But we know that cleaning them up is very costly, and so cleanups are done very slowly and haphazardly and incompletely. And the other issues we have is that Oregon's rules around emissions are pretty inadequate. And what we know about what's there in the greenhouse, there are greenhouse gases, and methane is a big one because there's a lot of LNG tanks, so that's the liquefied natural gas. And methane, we've been seeing that in the media, how harmful that is to our health, asthma and cancers and so on. So this
last line is really important to me. Portland is our home. It's not a sacrifice zone. And this organization, you can go to their website, tankthetanks.org, and learn more about what's being done or what you might want to do. So a sacrifice zone is a place where dangerous pollution, waste, and undesirable impacts of urban living is deposited, creating a myth that the land is not valuable, that the rivers are not valuable, and that no one of importance lives there or works there, for that matter. Okay, so now we're going to go to a couple recent events and just kind of give you an idea how government is involved in this or not involved in it. Great victory happened in 2021 when the city council denied Zenith's permit to expand their operations. And we were all really very, very happy and proud about this. Until, just like what happened at the turn of the century, a year later, they granted the request. And they granted the request on a promise that Zenith would, in the future, develop renewable energy. Yeah, no teeth to it, no timeline, nothing. And this was done without any community involvement. And part of that is because the sanctuary law serves as a barrier to community involvement. So this is the group of people 50 people who showed up at City Hall and protested this permit on the basis that it was inappropriate with the city's plan. Okay, so these are the things that I think are really important. That this zoning of an industrial sanctuary does prohibit just simple things, like the Audubon Society wanted to put some bushes and trees in so the salmon that do have to go through this horrendous 15 miles of toxins can rest and feed and so on. And that was denied several times. The city of Linton wanted to put a park in, and that was denied. The other thing is, not only is there the sanctuary, but if you're on the Portland Harbor Board of Directors, you are appointed. So there's no election there. There's no way for community members to be to have a say. And we do know that the fossil fuel industry there, all of them, are under-reporting their emissions because they use a formula that's been developed by the fossil fuel companies. And the other thing that really surprised me is there's no public fire department in this area. So each of the companies that have tanks there or other toxic waste, flammable materials, are to do their own firefighting. And then one last thing I'm going to leave you with. So three times over the years, Linton has asked the DEQ to put in air quality monitors. The community has gone out and actually, like citizen science, put instrumentation in this area and have far different counts of emissions than the fossil fuel industry is providing. And three times it's been denied. And one of the reasons that it's been denied is that the state government, DEQ in this instance, they're fearful that if they approve this, then the fossil fuel companies will come back with legal means to constrict their scope. And we saw that, I don't know if you saw the Supreme Court just restricted the EPA's ability to function in the area of wetland management. So that's a real threat. So this is an example of things that that we're up against, and that these efforts we've got a century of legacy practices that we're going to continue to need to resist and push against. The Linton Homeowners Association, or Linton Community Neighborhood Association, is a good place to go and see what's happening there. So thank you for your time and attention.
We are running quite a long bit over our normal time for a Sunday service. I would like to continue with the service as it goes. For those of you that are wanting to stay, it is at this point in our service on Sunday that we talk about our coming together. Life is a bittersweet journey, and every one of its parts are important. So as we said earlier, your wholeness is welcome here, the visible parts and the invisible parts.
May I be filled with love and kindness.
Hello, everyone. I'm Natalie Reich. She, her. And I'm small time compared to some of our other speakers that we had earlier, but I wanted to share a little bit about my experience volunteering for Western Farmworkers of America and of Washington County of America. Anyway, my original inspiration for volunteering with them was they were doing some tabling outside of my local market, and I started to learn about how hard the people who provide us food have to work to make sure they have food, and that most of them, live in fear of deportation, and they live in poverty and food insecurity despite our dependence on them. Then I came to WWF one day, and Leisha, who was their main organizer at the time, spoke to us about them, about volunteer opportunities. And I was also inspired by Linda and Jack Smith, who were very dedicated to that group and would go out there weekly to help them on what they called Benefit Assistance Day every Wednesday. And so I started going out with them, or independently, not as regularly as them, but often going out there to help folks dealing with things like threatened power shutoffs, eviction, and other problems for a while. Some of the experiences I had, one particularly satisfying one, was a young man who had been injured on the job and was really not able to go back to his former work and was having trouble getting a note from his doctor, and I actually went to an appointment with him. For some reason, he was not, probably because he was undocumented and didn't want to be too public about anything, couldn't get an interpreter, which is actually a legal right to have a medical interpreter attend. And so I did my best to go with him and interpret for the doctor, and he began to understand what this young man was dealing with and wrote him a note so that he was given a lighter duty job. And that was just kind of a one-off thing. Many members of this group, in between picking jobs, or sometimes they move on to other work. It might be restaurant work or landscaping, usually labor-intensive employment. And they continue to remain marginalized and continue to support and be supported by this self-help organization. I've always been impressed by the member involvement. It really is a self-help organization, kind of under the radar. All members are required to volunteer one way or another. They don't even have a website because they are under the radar. So many people are at risk of deportation at any time. I've continued to work occasionally at some of their very well-organized functions that occur annually or biannually, food deliveries, especially during COVID. There was a connection between Western Farmworkers and another organization that's in Portland. Western Farmworkers is out in Hillsboro. And I would pick up food that had been donated. I was amazed at how much my little Prius could hold, and bring it back to the Western Farmworkers office to be delivered to homes. Other times they have food drives, especially holiday season, where I think many woofers, I've seen many woofers, go out there and bring bags and bags of food to members' homes, which is always greatly appreciated. They have annual backpack events where at the beginning of each school year, WOOF and other church communities donate items, and then they're stuffed in backpacks and very well organized according to grade level, and then the members come with their families and collect the backpacks. Toy drives, coat drives, free eye care events. Kaiser optometrists would come once a year. I don't know if this is still happening. It didn't happen during COVID. But they would come once a year and fill up a room with their little examination equipment, and people, members could come and get a free eye exam, and glasses were donated. They could pick out glasses. Tamale making. I think most of you are familiar with the tamales that are sold here. I don't know how often, but it's always a treat when they are. So I encourage you to help however you can, weekly, monthly, or on call as needed. I think on Wednesdays is the day that they have orientation for new volunteers. They may have another time of the week as well. This group is run by dedicated young people and older people with amazing organizing skills that they teach to members and volunteers. If you speak any Spanish, that's a big plus, but it's not necessary. There's almost always people around who can do a little interpreting, and even if there aren't, you know, you manage with sign language and whatever. And their headquarters is in a very nice older home. It's a homey place. There's always food in the fridge that's available to volunteers and members. And it's a joyous place to be. So that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
Good morning. I am Luz Maciel Villarroel, and I work at the Dreamers Resource Center. And it truly has been an honor, a blessing, and humbling to hear all the testimonies here. Because without your support, without everything you're doing, our Dreamers, our people without immigration status, will not be able to survive in this country. We know that many of them go home very disappointed, but the majority stay forever, just like our pioneers there and other immigrants that have come before us. As I said, with that community, there is no gains. With that parallel movement from each group here, each group in our communities, we will not be able to survive. Because as it has been mentioned, United Farm Workers in general, if they don't stay, they are not here. Our food is going to continue to go up in prices. And we're only as strong as our weakest link. So I admire very much, ever since I arrived in this country, the commitment of community service, volunteering, getting up and giving, getting up and fixing, getting up and doing things. The Dreamers Resource Center was honored actually this Thursday by the Social and Civic Responsibility Path at PCC. And I just want to share with you a bag with a quote that it really actually is aligned with what we are doing here. They had about six different quotes. Back, and I chose this one because it really is aligned with what has been said here and what we all are trying to do here. It says, "You cannot change any society." You cannot change any society unless you see yourself as belonging to it and responsible for changing it. I truly feel that your community, Sulima, Cassie, Wendy, and other people here have guided and supported the Dreamers Resource Center into getting a lot of funds, into serving a lot of students, into responding to their needs, which has been the theme here. And I applaud your selfless spirit, your giving spirit, your kindness. It really, I can feel it coming from your heart. I'm on the verge of crying because what I see here, this is what gives me strength. This is what keeps me going. A lot of my students say, how come you have more energy than us? And I say, because I surround myself with people with similar care and similar background. You know, as you all go in your journey of serving, I'm right here on your hands. I'm writing. I'm on your shoulders. I'm writing. And some of you have done it longer than myself, and I will continue to do this only as long as we all are helping each other, because I would not be here without any of you. Suleyma asked me to please highlight things that we are doing at PCC and just briefly give you a rundown of what we're doing. The latest program that I have implemented, I unfortunately didn't have the chance to do this, but I will go ahead and talk a little bit about the Faculty Ambassadors Program, newly created at PCC by Dreamers. So yesterday I met with them, five people. We have about seven faculty members, and they all will be volunteering on different campuses to make sure they address the academic success, social, and other areas of concern for the students. Some of them were hesitant because they say, you know, students don't really want us around in their centers. I say, you'd be surprised. You know, I was led by mentors, always by mentors. So this program is newly instituted, and it just came to my mind that if any of you want to serve as a community mentor or ambassador, let me know. I'll be happy to have you come to our centers and volunteer. Yesterday, that was our agenda. I'm going to go real briefly because I know some of you want to go home probably. We also have the legal clinic, the CLEAR clinic, where students, faculty, and community can actually go and get support with expungements, with DACA renewals, with immigration questions, and with any other type of immigration issues. This year, I was very fortunate to have served on the National Association of Bilingual Educators Planning Committee, National Committee, and the conference went really, really well. Here in Oregon, we started supporting bilingual education since back in 1969 with one of my mentors. So this has been going on for a long time in Oregon. We want those languages that come here to thrive and be utilized. I think it's tragic when certain groups of people were led to forget their native language and just learn English. That is very tragic because through language we understand more things. Through language we're able to sense and feel more things. We also have an illumination project at PCC, which students actually create small acts, and then about eliminating racism, exclusivity, and other types of racism. So we have students in that and are benefiting with grants and tuition waivers. So this is one way that we can support Dreamers who do not qualify for any type of financial aid. A newly formed program is CALIS, a program that's giving all Spanish surnames the opportunity to enroll in whether it's a college track class or whether it's a certificate. So that one also is paying for their tuition. And these are funds the PCC has raised along with other folks in the community and in the government. We had a Happy Earth. We participated in this, Happy Earth. And it was an amazing event. Actually, Dreamers Resource Center bought some straws that you can use forever and ever. And we donated those to the students that participated and made like a promise of how they're going to take care of the earth. So we wanted this to be interactive. We also participated in the Justice Environment Committees. We also went to the Capitol on May 1st, May Day, to make sure that any type of employee, any type of trabajador is paid respect, is given the right wages. So we were advocating there for the whole day. This year, instead of instituting Hispanic Month in September, we actually instituted the Honoring Our Indigenous Heritage 529 Years of Resistance events. And it was really, really a learning experience because, as you know, since we were conquered by the Spaniards and other people throughout the world, we forgot about our indigenous background. So this gave us an opportunity to revisit who we are besides the other cultures that we embrace. We also participated, and I love this program. This is called Chiquitas Program. We bring third through seventh graders to PCC, and we inspire them to keep moving forward towards envisioning themselves on a campus, envisioning themselves on getting a college education. One of my most painful event that I plan every year for a month is called What is Human Trafficking? As you know, immigrants, specifically female immigrants with no documents, are more likely to be trafficked. I was told that a lot of those women that you see in front of stores with little baskets or with flowers, that they are actually being trafficked. So I tried to talk to one of them in Salem as I ran into the trafficked women that were there, and they pretended they didn't understand me. I said, "Are you being trafficked? Is there anything I can do? Do you want to go with me?" And they just, and then there was another person kind of watching them, and then they just kind of start walking towards that person. Two students wanted to celebrate again Cinco de Mayo, commemorate Cinco de Mayo, so we did that because the students wanted it. and it turned out really well. We collaborated a lot with the Veterans Resource Center, who also need a lot of support. Any veterans here, look for a veterans center at Portland Community College. They can use your support in many, many, many ways. They're very affected with what is going on in our community and the lack of support that they feel they're not getting. We also, instead of Halloween, we celebrated Dia de los Muertos. It was very joyful because we brought Mexican chocolate, Mexican bread, and we had about over 200 or 300 students and faculty and staff coming to our center and getting a cup of hot chocolate and Mexican bread. We also are hiring students thanks to your generous donations to the foundation. Now we have some funds to hire assistantships because a lot of our students don't have immigration status. They cannot work, so I have created an assistantship program, which means they will get a stipend, about $1,500 a quarter, and then they will get their tuition paid. So this is, you know, this is how they reached out to get hired. And right now we're going to go into the process of interviewing them. We also have created a path to scholarships, and we are working with students all year long to teach them how to write essays, how to research for scholarships, how to research for financial aid or for ORSA. And we collaborate with other centers. I utilize this book because I learned from McBride, Mrs. McBride, many, many, many years ago when I was working for migrant education. It is an amazing program. So if any of you would like to come and participate as helping with essay writing, reviewing essays for them, I will send the guide to Cassie and to Sulema and to Wendy. Let me see what else. I think that's it. Any questions? Yes.
You have the question. How would you have in your day?
Don't take my thing. No, I won't. Let me see. I know that's what my students say. Do you ever sleep? You know, these are mine. Believe it or not, I do sleep. I'm very, I'm a very sleepy head, so I do sleep and I do rest and I do swim every morning. Every morning I swim. So I'm taking Zulma's papers, I'm sorry. But I do rest, I do swim, and the president came on Friday to an event for youth so that we can, you know, they came and presented the documents and research on some of the isms, and then they came up with solutions. The president from our college, who's a brand new president, came and sat with us and ate breakfast. So when I told her her age, well, yeah, you should be retiring, right? And I said, but this is what I love to do. You know, if I retire, I'm
retiring for you. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Those of you that have stayed, thank you. We really appreciate it. It was not our intention to run over time, but we have so much that is so important to be addressed. And there we are. So this week marked two anniversaries in our country's dark history of gun violence and police brutality. 3 years ago, on May 25th, we witnessed the murder of George Floyd, which made a bit of difference for a little while. And on the 24th,
we marked the 1 year. 1 year since the Robb Elementary School massacre in Uvalde, Texas. Between Columbine, 1999, and the Covenant School, 2023, there have been more than 380 mass shootings in schools, including Sandy Hook Elementary just before Christmas of 2012, and Parkland High School, Valentine's Day, 2018. Over and over again, the question gets asked, does America love its guns more than it loves its children? Our guest musician this morning, Terry Graham, is a singer, songwriter, and community activist. And she's going to address that question.
Okay. So this needs to come over and the guitar. Which will go here. Takes a village. Okay, can you hear my voice?
Yes.
Can you hear my guitar? Okay, great. So this song came out of rage. Channeling rage into something creative is something I find that works for me. And there's a couple of places in this song where I do some what I call keening. Keening, there are other words for it, but I think you know what I mean. And you're certainly welcome to join in on that part. This is called Daughters and Sons. Well, it's happened again, this time in Nashville, armed, unprepared, and ready to kill anyone in the path of the bullet spray. Well, it's just another day in the U.S. of A. Your thoughts and your prayers, your phony tears, we get your messages loud and clear. You want more rights for your goddamn guns than we have for our daughters and sons. And you outlaw a drag show, transgender youth, priorities twisted, denying the truth. It's the guns, it's the guns, it's the guns, it's the guns, killing our daughters and sons. Now we've nowhere to go, no place that feels safe, not grade schools or dance halls or houses of faith. The Second Amendment so misunderstood, robbing our babies of childhood. Oh, the weapons they use are intended to slaughter innocent people served up as fodder, an AR-15 in the hands of a teen, killing our sons and our daughters. And each time this happens, we scream, not one more. You turn away, you choose to ignore. Clear where you and the NRA stand. You have so much blood on your hands. Now we've nowhere to go, no place that feels safe, not colleges, concerts, or houses of faith. You think the solution for our daughters and sons is a good guy with a gun. It's the guns, it's the guns, it's the guns, it's the guns, killing our daughters and sons. It's the guns, it's the guns, it's the goddamn guns, killing our daughters and sons. Killing your daughters and sons.
I'd like to acknowledge the Wolf Marathon today. So if you're new here, but we don't do this every Sunday, but it's just amazing to hear the passion and commitment. So I have a few brief remarks. So first of all, everyone, I'm Brad Hewitt. My pronouns are he and him. And kind of in the vein of what we've just been talking about regarding gun violence, it was 25 years ago last week that a 15-year-old Kiplin Kinkle walked into Thurston High School in Springfield, Oregon, armed with 3 firearms and 1,100 rounds of ammunition. After having killed both his parents the night before, Kiplin killed 2 of his classmates and wounded 25. Physician Dan Hagengruber from Eugene remembers it this way. I was the first anesthesiologist for my group to arrive at the emergency room at Sacred Heart Hospital when the wounded started coming in. I helped care for the first 3 victims who arrived and stayed with the 3rd in the operating room for the rest of the day. The sense of overwhelming tragedy hung over all of us that day because we had never really experienced a mass school shooting before. It's not the kind of situation any healthcare professional or anyone else wants to be in. Dr. Hagengruber adds, since then, as Salima said, America has witnessed more than 380 school shootings. Here in Oregon, so many of us were forever changed by the Thurston shootings. Today, children, educators, families, and whole communities carry the trauma and the worry of gun violence every day. This is a uniquely American problem, and while gun violence is all too common, we should never accept it as normal. How American is this problem? And I'm happy to share these slides if anyone would like. This 2017 data shows we have more than 20 times more guns per person than the global average. A total of 393 million guns. Our most recent census is 392 million people. Still more guns than people. Interestingly, another 27 survey found that 30% of Americans were gun owners, showing that super owners having 10 guns or more account for the bulk of the ownership. And this American problem has spread to our schools. With every state having experienced a school shooting, the medium circles indicate 10 or more shootings and the large 20 or more. And with the exception of the pandemic year of 2000, the general trend has been upward almost consistently the last 10 years since the initial spike in the mid-1980s, leading us to a place where, as of 2020, firearms are the leading cause of death of American children. So please remember these shocking numbers on the charts are each human tragedies. The students in this lunchroom in Thurston had the right to live their lives in peace. The students in this room had the right to spend their days at school not having to worry about being killed. No child should ever have to be led from school covered in their own or someone else's blood. No one else starts out to be a killer. Mental illness or other combinations of social, emotional, and physical factors often build until horrendously sad events happen. This is Kipling Kinkle, who had committed the shootings in Thurston. I encourage you to please join me in supporting one of these or another statewide organization in Oregon engaged in political efforts to implement existing legislation or pass legislation aimed at reducing gun violence. Money matters more than signs and letters of support at this point in our corporatized democracy for hire. So please give as you're able. And also, Ceasefire Oregon does have a really good update on what's happening with Oregon legislation if you'd like. So thank you for your time.
Again, thank you so much for coming this morning. Thank you so much for staying this morning. We really appreciate it. So as we come to the end of our time together, let us be mindful of all that we've heard and seen. And let us lean into all that it means to be an American on this Memorial Day weekend, remembering that I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. We are here together on what is still our beautiful planet. Let us not fail to do that something that is ours to do, for the sake of freedom and justice. Our closing music is a little different today. It's easy to learn.